We're getting near the end of 1 Kings, or I guess we are at the latter part of 1 Kings chapter 16 here in our study. Looking right now at some of these kings of Israel, the northern kingdom. This chapter, 1 Kings 16, is covering several of those kings, beginning with Baasha, the one that killed Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, who was the second king of Israel. That was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat's son, who reigned for a full calendar year, early in the reign of, corresponding to the early part of the reign of Asa, king of Judah. And then Baasha destroyed, murdered all of Jeroboam's house in fulfillment of God's prophecy. And so then he did the same things that Jeroboam did. He walked in all of his sins. That was how chapter 15 closed in verse 34. So then the Lord sent a prophet, Jehu, the other Jehu. We haven't been introduced to Jehu, the son of Nimshi yet, who's Ahab's captain, the one that ended up executing vengeance on the house of Ahab. But we're about to read about Ahab now as he's going to become king here at the end of 1 Kings 16. But Jehu, the son of Hanani, the prophet, the Lord sent to prophesy against Baasha. God was going to do the same thing to Baasha in his house that he had done to Jeroboam. Baasha had been the instrument to bring that judgment on the house of Jeroboam. But he's doing the same things, and so God was going to do the same thing with him. Well, after Baasha died, his son Elah became king, and exactly like Jeroboam's son, Elah reigned for one full calendar year. But then he was murdered on all of his house by Zimri, and Zimri was a servant and was captain of half the chariots in Israel at that time. And Zimri lasted a week, after he became king. But then Omri, who was the captain of the host in Israel, he was not going to let his underling become king, and so he went besieged Tirzah, and then Zimri burned the palace down on himself, and so he died after a reign of a week. But we also saw that with Zimri, it said that he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam. So God had a rebuke for not just Jeroboam, who started all that. That goes back to 1 Kings 12, when he created that new religion for his kingdom and forbade his subjects from going to Jerusalem like God had commanded. So he set up an entirely new religion to supplant, replace God's religion in his kingdom. And so he had his own priests, he had his own feast days, he had his own altar. So he provided those golden calves in Dan and Bethel. So he did all of that. But then it said his successors continued in their sins. His son, Nadab, even though he was king for only a full year, as we notice, God said that he walked in all the ways of his father. And so that was part of why he was, even though his reign was comparatively brief, he was worthy of that judgment against him. So how long did God consider it sufficient time to do something about evil when he was given the authority by God to do so? Well, we could easily conclude certainly less than a year if God rebuked and condemned him because he had been king that long and had done and continued in those sins. And the same exact thing he said about Baasha's son Elah. Well, then Zimri, the one who killed Elah in Baasha's house, reigned for a week. But God rebuked and condemned him because he had continued in those sins. So how long does the Lord expect somebody that he gives authority to do something about evil that's under their purview? Immediate. That's why we compared to the Apostle Paul. It was, on the other hand, David. We saw when as soon as he was anointed, well, he was anointed by God originally to be king of Israel before Saul's death. And it took a long time before, well, first his own tribe of Judah to recognize and follow God's decision that God had already made concerning David, and then for the rest of the tribes of Israel to do that. And Brother Johnson did a very detailed overview of all that about the house of Saul and its decline, especially with their captain, and as they were continuing to try to follow the house of Saul. But it took a long time before they finally recognized God's decision about David to be king over all Israel. And so he actually got anointed three times, David did. First by the Lord through Samuel, and then secondly by Judah, and then thirdly by all Israel, which was the anointing that really made him king. Of course, it was the one that God directed Samuel to do. But the others were just the progressive recognition by the other Israelites of what God had long ago decided. But anyway, what did David do as soon as he actually possessed the, not just the authority from God, but the ability and the actual power to do something about what was in Israel? Immediately. So what was his first act as king? Went to Jerusalem. Jebus, as it was called then, that was occupied by the Jebusites. And that was something that had existed for about, what was 500 years at that point. Those people were still there right in the midst of Israel. And how did what did David think about that? I mean, that was a 500-year-old blight on Israel's history, a glaring demonstration of their lack of obedience. And it was technically part of the land that God had divided by lot, given to Benjamin, even though it was the Brook Kidron right outside the walls of the city, was the border with Judah's territory. And so one of their own, Saul, the son of Kish, who was Israel's first king, was a Benjamite. What did he do about, in his 40-year reign, what did he do about the Jebusites that were occupying that city right there in his own territory? Nothing. So David became king, and his first act immediately went and did something about that. Conquered the city. Then he made it his city. Well, he was the one that nobody else did anything about it, so he did. So did that give him some right to say who was going to occupy it and do what with it? Yes. And then he had in mind for that to be the new location, to be the center, the capital of Israel, and not just the political capital, but where the people would go to worship and serve the Lord. And that's when he had the very next chapter in 2 Samuel 7 is when he had the idea to, well, to bring the Ark of the Covenant there and then to build a temple for a permanent location for it. So all the rest of his acts were then all part of that. So David was driven to try to correct those problems that were spiritual problems that were in Israel that long predated his becoming king. But as soon as he had the ability to do something about it, he acted on it immediately and diligently. We looked at Saul in Galatians, Paul, the apostle in Galatians 2, when they were trying to circumcise Titus and subject him to bring him under the law of Moses. He was a Gentile, a Greek. So they were trying to impose the law of Moses onto the Gentile converts. And how long did Paul say that he put up with that false doctrine? Not for an hour. So we can see from all of that, when God gives authority, he's going to judge us as stewards over what he puts into our hands. Whatever abilities we have, how we use the time he gives us, the physical strength and all the blessings he gives us, any authority that he gives us, and if we're letting something go on that's not right, I mean, who's responsible for what's taught and what's practiced here at North Columbia? We are. And if we allow error and falsehood to go on here, what will God do? I mean, he'll judge us for that. If somebody's trying to bring that in, how long should we tolerate that? Not for a moment. We have these examples of that. But anyway, Tirzah lasted a week, he walked in Jeroboam's ways, even if it was only that long. But that week began with his murder of his predecessor and all of his family. So his brief reign was marked by murder and falsehood, and so out he went. And then Omri was involved in a struggle for the next several years with one of his rivals, Tidni, because we had Israel divided and following those two. That went on as we read about there in verse 21 of 1 Kings 16. The people were divided in half, half wanted to follow Tidni and the other half Omri. There was a struggle for the throne. Eventually, Omri prevailed, and it says that so Tidni died. It's a strong suggestion that his death was directly related to that conflict with Omri. Omri became king, it says in verse 23, in the 31st year of Asa, the king of Judah. Zimri had become king in the 27th year of Asa. So here it is, that was a four-plus year struggle for the throne. Then Omri prevailed, he became king. He reigned 12 years over Israel, 6 years he reigned in Tirzah. And then he bought the hill of Samaria from Shemer for 2 talents of silver. Doesn't seem like a lot. For buying a hill that he made to be the capital of Israel. But then Samaria, as he turns that into the capital, will remain the capital of Israel until the end of the kingdom, all the way through Hosea, the 19th and final kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel. This is the sixth king, so there are 13 after Omri that all reign from Samaria. So that's the new capital for Israel until it falls by the Assyrians. And then the Assyrians moved their people in, but that became such a prominent place in Israel, the ones the Assyrians brought in from those other nations that they conquered that were not Israelites, and they brought in their idol worshiping, and they ended up adding the worship of Jehovah to their false religion. And that persisted all the way to the time of the New Testament, to the time of Christ. But what were those people and their descendants, what did they became known as? The what? The Samaritans, called by that name of that area, because that was the capital and the prominent area then in Israel, particularly north of Israel. This is a historic moment this is a very notable moment in the history of Israel, with Samaria becoming the capital under Omri. But then we want to read now what it says, just to refresh on what it says about Omri and his reign. There's a lot more about the struggle and how he became king, and then the fact that he bought Samaria and made that the capital. But there are only 4 verses that describe his actual reign. And what he did, and how he lived, and how he ruled. Well, 4 verses here, 25 through 28 of 1 Kings 16. Of course, it's only the only verses we need to tell us exactly what kind of person he was. And it goes a long way to explaining Ahab, his son, that becomes king after him, starting in verse 29. But let's go ahead and read 25 through 28 here, 1 Kings chapter 16. Brother David Broody, would you read that for us, please? 1 Kings 16, 25 through 28.
Omri, the Lord, as the Lord, and worse than all, the Lord, walking on the way of the earth.
Okay, so Omri, his life and reign is summed up there in verse 25. Not a long description there, lengthy description. It's very succinct, but it tells us all we need to know. He wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord and did worse than all that were before him. So he's the sixth king of Israel. And if we're going to the first five, beginning with Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, his son Nadab, then Baasha and his son Elah, and then Zimri, those are your first five. Good or evil?
Totally evil.
All right, so it started, of course, with Jeroboam. So we're just going to write them down here. Jeroboam, and then we had Nadab. We'll draw a line there because now it changes to the house, to Baasha and his house. And so we have him, and then we have Zimri, and now we have Omri. Okay, so until Omri, of these first five, Jeroboam, Nadab. All right, let's start with Jeroboam and Nadab. Who was worse, father or son? Well, both the same, except for what? One started and the other continued. On that basis, Nadab continued for a year what his father had started. Would we consider Jeroboam to be quite evil for being the one that actually founded all of this evil and turning away the people to away from the Lord? So he not only made the decision to reject God and not follow him, but then he was directly causing not just a few, but the majority of the tribes and people of the nation of Israel that were God's people, turning them away from, forbidding them from following the Lord and obeying him, and then turning them to falsehood in their religion. When we're looking at Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and we look at all the ones that we read about in the Bible, all the wicked ones there, there's some that are way up high in that. Balaam is one, as he's given as an example of, he really exemplifies false teachers, as he, for money, and the promise of money, was willing to intentionally be a stumbling block to try to lead Israel into sin so that they could be cursed so he could get his money. Balaam did that, but Jeroboam started an entire false religion to try to turn the people away so he could keep his throne. I mean, from that standpoint, does Jeroboam rank up there? Does he rank with the rank? He's right up there. When we think of these ones that are in the Bible that are wicked, he's way up there at the top. He's among the worst. He's among the worst that we read about in God's Word. Nadab continued in his sins. So after Jeroboam, it says that Nadab continued, Baasha continued, Elah continued, Zimri continued. Does it say any of those ones after Jeroboam were worse than Jeroboam? They all continued in it, but did they do worse than that, or did they just persist in what Jeroboam started? They persisted it. Now, of course, you can throw on top of that, Baasha also murdered his Jeroboam's son and all of his family. And Zimri murdered Elah, Baasha's son, and then all of Baasha's family. So you've got murder on top of that with Baasha and Zimri. But as far as what they did in Israel and how God describes it, he tells us how wicked Jeroboam was, and over again tells us, and that he's the measuring stick for all those other ones that thereafter. In fact, all the way, we've only written the first six, but if we do the next 13 up there, finishing up with Hosea, although it's interesting with Hosea, it says that he was evil and walked in all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. This is in 2 Kings 17. But it says that he did not walk in evil like the ones before him. So that's the only one that says he was the least evil of all of them. But it does say that he walked in those sins of Jeroboam. So he was evil and continued in that. He didn't stop all that. From Jeroboam all the way to the end, that statement's made about all these kings, all 19 of them. But we only have this guy so far, where it says he did worse than all that were before him, and that would have to include Jeroboam. Jeroboam was before him, wasn't it? We're going to see some statements like that on the good side about some of Judah's kings, a couple of them. Now we'll have to be very particular in noticing the wording of that. Like for Hezekiah, that says that he trusted in the Lord. He trusted the Lord more than all the ones that were before him that reigned in Judah. I mean, it's very particular because he was king over Judah, not all Israel. So when we ask, well, if it was all before him, did Hezekiah trust the Lord more than David did? It doesn't say of all Israel like David reigned. So he's particularly among the ones that reigned in Judah. He had a trust in the Lord that exceeded all the ones before him and after him. Josiah will use similar language to talk about his obedience in keeping the law of Moses, that he did so more so than all those before him or after him in Judah. So that when we see the wording there with those with Hezekiah and Josiah, he's not putting them above David as far as David's trust and obedience. Hezekiah trusted, he trusted and obeyed, but he was heavy on the trust part, and Josiah was very heavy on the obey part. But did anybody trust and obey like David? No. And he doesn't put them above them. But this is a blanket statement about Omri. He was worse than all before him, all those other kings. That he doesn't say it for all the ones that reigned in Samaria, because he's the first one to do that. But he's worse than Jeroboam. Well, how? What does it say next in verse 26? Because if he's worse than Jeroboam, we doesn't it beg the question, well, how is he worse, or what did he did that made him worse than Jeroboam? How could you be worse than Jeroboam? Well, number one, what does it say in verse 26? He walked in all the way of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and his sins wherewith he made Israel to sin, to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger with their vanities. So he continued in Jeroboam's sins, but that's the same statement is made about all those other guys. So that's part of it, but that doesn't explain right there how he was worse. Well, what made Jeroboam so bad? We're going to see the reminder in what it's going to say about Omri, because, you know, we don't really read any other details than what he just says there in verse 26. But there's something there about Omri that was worse than Jeroboam, not just that he persisted in Jeroboam's sins, because the others had done so as well, but what did make Jeroboam so bad? If we don't have any other statement than what we have in these verses about Omri, it would be more challenging or difficult to say, well, here's what he did. This is why he was worse. But we can get an idea from what Jeroboam did. He was king, and he established that religion. He made, as king, he made laws for Israel. He said, when he made those golden calves, he says, "These be your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Israel." So he made a declaration that those were the gods they were to worship. He made that a law in his kingdom. You have to worship these golden calves, which God said, "Thou shalt make no other gods before me. Thou shalt not make unto thee. Thou shalt have no other gods before me." That's the first of the Ten Commandments. And number two, you shall not make unto you any graven image. So he made graven images and declared them to be their gods. And he didn't just worship them himself, but he made that a law and said to all Israel, "These are your gods. You're going to worship these gods. You can go to Dan or Bethel, but you're not going to Jerusalem. You're not going to there to worship Jehovah, the one who really did bring you up out of the land of Egypt. you're not going there anymore. You're not going to follow his commandment. He commanded, God commanded the people to go there. Jeroboam says, no, you will not obey God's commandment. My commandment is, here are your gods now. And here's where you're going to go. And here's when you're going to go there. And here are your priests. And here are your feast days. Here's the altar where you're going to bring your sacrifices. All these were laws that he made. Those are the details of the things at the end of 1 Kings 12. And all Israel had to follow them, so that the few that were determined they were going to continue to serve God, what did they have to do? There was only one option for them that we read about, and this is the option they chose within the first 3 years of Jeroboam's reign, which was simultaneous to Rehoboam in Judah to Jeroboam's time. So what happened? What did the people do that were going to follow God and not go after Jeroboam's false ways? They had one option. What was it? Leave. And they did. Some more did in Asa's time that we read about. But that was it. So if you wanted to follow God, you couldn't stay there. You could not stay in Israel, in that territory, governed by Jeroboam, and obey God. You could not do it. He made it impossible by design. But then the majority of the people, well, they had already turned to idols. That was the reason God split the kingdom anyway. How big of a jump was it for them from the idols they had turned to go after the new religion Jeroboam made up? It was not that big of a change, and so the majority went along with it. But the fact is, they went along with what Jeroboam established and made the state religion. And the fact that he did that is what made him so wicked. Well, if Omri was worse than Jeroboam, and he continued in everything that Jeroboam did, which it says he did, would it also suggest that Omri must have instituted some other things as king that went beyond just what Jeroboam did? He had to have. I mean, that would be the only way that he could be worse. And we also have a statement from the Lord about that. Not here in 1 Kings. But if we can turn to the book of Micah, to the Micah chapter 6. Now, even if you don't know all the references, I know that you all know very well, and you could, I think everybody in this room, at the drop of a hat, could quote verse 8 from this chapter, because we sing it frequently. He has showed you, O man, what is good. Remember that? Does that sound familiar? That's Micah 6, verse 8. What does the Lord require of man?
To do justice, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God.
That's it. That's Micah 6, 8. Well, after verse 8, he's going on to show how they had not been doing that. That's what God required. They had not been meeting that requirement. And so Micah the prophet, going back to the first verse of the book, he was a prophet that God had in place, and he prophesied during. He identifies him with the reigns of the kings of Judah, from Jotham through into Hezekiah's reign. So he spanned quite a few kings, but he's identified with the timing of the kings of Judah. He doesn't tie that into and list the kings of Israel that were contemporaries at that time. That doesn't mean that Micah's words were all directed towards in rebuke of Judah. It was, but it tells us at the beginning of the book that he prophesied against Samaria and Jerusalem, the two capitals. So God had him rebuking both because, well, what was going on in both kingdoms for the majority of Micah's? Now, we know what was going on in the north because none of them ever departed from these sins. But in the southern kingdom in Judah, Jotham was one that, we're going to read, he had turned away from the Lord, and we also read about down through Ahaz, who was the worst of Judah's kings, the father of Hezekiah. So the only righteous king that Micah ever saw in his lifetime was Hezekiah. All the other ones in Judah and in Israel were wicked. So what was going on in all of Israel, Judah and Israel, during Micah's time with that exception of what happened at the end there, near the end of Micah's time when Hezekiah was king. I mean, it was all wickedness. So he was rebuking the wickedness everywhere. That's what God inspired him to do. But in Micah chapter 6, he's showing how the people, Israel and Judah, had not been meeting God's requirements. They had not been doing righteously. They did not love mercy. They weren't walking humbly with God. And he outlines that through the rest of the chapter, but it's interesting to read the last verse of Micah 6, which pertains to our study at hand. Say, Brother Michael, can you read Micah chapter 6 and verse 16, please?
For the statutes of Omri are kept in all the works of the house of Ahab, and you walk in their counsels, that I should make thee a desolation, and the inhabitants thereof a hissing. Therefore, you shall bear the reproach of my people.
What does that say there at the very beginning of the verse? The statutes of Omri are kept. What are the statutes of Omri? What are statutes? Those are laws. He doesn't say with Jeroboam there, does he? Well, we know those were being kept too. But doesn't that tell us right there that Omri made other statutes that persisted after him? That God is singling out, specifically singling out here being part of why he was going to bring punishment upon them. So when we're considering, well, how was Omri worse than all before, including Jeroboam? Well, he persisted in all the things that Jeroboam did, and he added to it. Now, if you want to ask me, well, what were those specific statutes that he made? I don't know. He doesn't tell us. But we know that he made them, and it wasn't just one. The statutes of Omri were kept. So he made laws. There were other things that he did that he made the law of the land that were obviously directly against the commandments of God. And so when you add all that together, he continued into all those things that Jeroboam had done and making his evil statutes, and then he made up all of it. He made a bunch more. So how easy would it have been if you lived in Omri's time and you were born into Israel and you decided you wanted to seek the Lord? Now, how many people were left in Israel that were seeking the Lord at that time? I mean, they were all, I mean, we did read about some more that went down into Judah and Asa's time. And some of these may have included some of what was going on when Omri became king and made more statutes. That certainly could have been behind part of that. But how many people were following the Lord in this kingdom? Very few. Now, how many were responsible before God for doing so? How many could justifiably say, well, my parents were following evil and I just didn't know better, so you can't blame me? How many today can justifiably say, well, nobody taught me the truth in my house when I was growing up, and so I just followed this tradition I was taught my family, even though it was wrong? How many are going to be able to go to judgment day and say, you can't blame me, Lord, I didn't know any better? That would be called what? It starts with an E. An excuse. And in Romans 1, what does the Lord say that nobody has? No excuse. There's no one that has an excuse for not following God, not glorifying God as God. There's nobody that has an excuse for not knowing that they have a Maker and that they should seek Him to live for Him and Him only. How do we all know, in spite of whatever wickedness may be going around, maybe around us in our families or in our nation, the world around us, how many of us do not know that we have a Creator and that knowledge and that fact that we have a Creator obligates us to seek Him and live for Him? We all know that. And the Lord tells us, of course, by the things that are made by the creation, that is clearly seen. So that's why he says it without excuse. So was there anybody in Israel that had an excuse for not seeking God and serving Him? No matter what evil was going on, they didn't. What about Ahab, Omri's own son? No excuse for him either. So there's no excuse for anybody. They should have been seeking the Lord, but if someone did, in spite of all this wickedness, and they said, well, I know I have a God, and it can't be this golden calf over here. There's no way He made me, or it made me. I need to find who my Maker is and seek Him and live for Him. If somebody had that thought on whatever level where they were feeling after God, God all promises if anyone seeks to find, who could have been doing, who could have sought the Lord and obeyed him in Israel in Omri's time? How difficult would that have been? I mean, it would have been difficult enough from Jeroboam down, but now Omri's added all whatever it is that he added, his statutes to it. It would have been impossible. It would have literally been impossible. So that's what he says about Omri. And so he's the most wicked king that has ever been in Israel until his son takes over. So his holding that title of worst ever, it doesn't last very long. It's a very brief title that he holds. Because his son's going to come in and take that claim for himself. He's going to become the worst of all time. Now, if we're going to try to find God making it a statement after Ahab that any one of those successors or ones that became king after Ahab were worse than Ahab, we're not going to find that. So, when we think of wicked people in the Bible, I mean, we should remember Jeroboam. We should remember Balaam. We should also, of course, remember Omri, but Ahab. Well, that's the next one we get to look at. Ahab becomes the next king of Israel, and he is going to be the worst king that is ever going to be in God's land. And we could ask, well, how could he even be worse than his father because of who he married? It's virtually impossible to think of Ahab without thinking of who else? Jezebel. Those two go together. We won't say peanut butter and jelly, whatever the opposite is. Those are two things. It's hard to mention the one without the other. They go together, but if we wanted to think of... I want to think of probably the all-time worst marriage. This may take the prize. Ahab and Jezebel together, and because they're together, I mean, they're going to accomplish together what neither one could have accomplished by themselves. And he's going to highlight that as being what made Ahab to be even worse than Omri. So we're going to read now about Ahab and Jezebel in the beginning of their time in Israel. So we'll go ahead and read these last few verses of 1 Kings 16, verses 29 through 34. Brother Trey, can you do that for us, please? Asa's reign is going to include at least part of the reigns of the first seven kings of Israel. Shortly after he becomes king that Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was Israel's first king, dies. But then all these other ones that we've been reading about from the end of 1 Kings 15 all the way to Ahab now, as it pinpoints when they became king, and it ties them into the reign of Asa. So Asa had a very lengthy reign as king of Judah. That's why it took us a while to get through studying about him. But this is what all has been going on in Israel to the north through all these years of his reign. I mean, just thinking about this, I mean, all these different kings and different ones getting murdered and then bringing in more laws that are against God. I mean, the wickedness is running rampant in the northern kingdom, in Israel. And so it's in that environment, Ahab, the son of Omri, begins to reign over Israel in Asa's 38th year. And he reigned over Israel in Samaria, so that was the capital city now that was established by his father, and he reigned there in that capital for 22 years. Now, as we've noted before, and as we see that with the tie-in with Asa and his reign, that reign, the Talmud says he reigned 22 years, that is, by the way Israel counted it, that includes his first year. From the time he became king, he was counted as reigning a year, so the accession year is counted as year one by their method. So if you go by calendar years and how long he actually reigned, it would correspond to 21 years. But 22 years, by the way, they counted it. So, but as far as the reigns over Israel, that puts him, well, just a couple, 2 years less than Baasha. So the only ones, I've already erased them, but Jeroboam, Baasha, and now Ahab are the only ones that have had lengthy reigns. I mean, Omri's was 12, which means an actual 11. So Ahab was given quite a while. We could ask why. Why did God just take him out as soon as he said, "I do," to Jezebel? There was only one way that could go. The way it went, but God had a purpose, didn't he? And he had a lot of work he was going to be doing, and much like what he says about Pharaoh, and that's in the book of Exodus, but also repeated in Romans 9, God endured with much long suffering that Pharaoh, who was a vessel of wrath fitted to destruction. Does God sometimes put wicked people in positions because there's stuff that has to be done that only those ones will do? And then God is enduring, they're doing that for whatever purpose needs to be done. Well, we know that. It states that. Would that describe Ahab? Did God endure him with much long suffering as a vessel of wrath fitted to destruction? I mean, it would certainly fit the pattern. So God kept him there for several years. I mean, was he there for that long because Ahab was seeking God and God was going to bring him finally to repentance? Neither he nor Jezebel. In fact, it's not going to be long before the prophecies are made by the Lord about how their end is going to come and why. So it's not for hope for them, really. It's what's going on for all of these people in that area. This is a terrible time in Israel and in that kingdom. And when we think about it, I mean, we're not that many. I mean, Asa is now just the third king of Judah after Solomon's death. So has it really been that long after David and Solomon where you had that 80 years where the people followed the Lord in all Israel, other than the end of Solomon's time when they started turning to idols? But for the better part of 80 years, you had the people following the Lord. How long did it take for things to get this bad? It didn't take very long, did it? It happened in a very quick time. Well, with looking around us today, how fast are things changing in our time? And we don't mean for the good. It really is. It's fast. I mean, it's really... it's astonishing how quickly, how fast things are going away, even further away from what's good, and wickedness is prevailing in so many ways. But it can happen. A lot can change in a short period of time. But now we're getting rock bottom here in the northern kingdom in Ahab's time. It says in verse 30 that he did evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him. Does that include the one that verse 25 mentioned had done, was worse, that did worse than all that were before him? It does. It has to be for that statement to be true. Does that mean Ahab did worse than Omri? Yes, he did worse than his father. Verse 31, how? Well, it says it came to pass as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So did he do that? He did. But what made that, did he do that, was there any regret? Was there any contemplation in his mind about, well, look at all and look at all these judgments that God has made already against the house of Jeroboam, against Baasha's house, and all, for all this evil, and look at what my father did, and I mean, is there any moment where he's thinking, this is all wrong, I need to do something about this? What does he consider these sins of Jeroboam? A light thing. I mean, it is no big deal to him at all. Nothing worthy of really any consideration or thought whatsoever. Because if it were, he sure would not have married who he married. So it says, as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took the wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians. What was Jezebel's father's name?
As Baal in the name?
Yes, he was named after Baal. So he goes and marries a princess, the daughter of neighboring king. This is one of the Phoenician kings right there to the north, who even took his name after the idol that they worshipped. And so what does Ahab think about marrying somebody who's such a devotee of Baal worship? That's the state religion in her kingdom that her father reigned over, and it's even her father's name. What does he think about that? Nothing, Brother Yon.
Just to know that Ethbaal literally means with Baal.
Yeah, right. That's what it means. He was with Baal, and that was his very name. So he marries the daughter of with Baal. And she comes to him with Baal and decides to make the whole nation to be with Baal. And so, I mean, Ahab becomes a devotee of Baal worship. So now, whatever, you have the statutes of Jeroboam, you have the statutes of Omri, and now we're going to get the statutes of Ahab. In fact, when we read in Micah 6, 18 a moment ago, he mentioned that the statutes of Omri were kept and all those things that Ahab did. So he mentioned both of those. Ahab is going to bring in a lot more because he's going to make Baal worship. So those golden calves are still there and all those sins of Jeroboam are still being kept, but he's going to add Baal worship and then make that the state religion for his kingdom too. He's going to take it beyond what any of his predecessors did, and it's going to be chiefly because of the one he married. We're out of time. We'll have to pick this up next week. Lord willing, we'll try to finish up that last bit of 1 Kings 16 and then start into chapter 17, where we're going to now start reading about Elijah the Tishbite, God's prophet, one of the mightiest prophets, one of the greatest prophets that ever were. His time is going to be very closely tied in with all that's going on in Israel under Baal's time. Baal's time through Ahab and Jezebel. So Lord willing, we'll continue there next Sunday morning. Brother Aaron, would you lead us in prayer as we close?